Mr. Damon here. I appreciate you coming. You see all these CDs. He's the one that sits at all these speaker meetings and goes down to the assembly and records all this stuff and hands it out. He's also what keeps our computers running at the office down there. So if something goes wrong, you know who to point at. Thank you so much.
All right.
Good evening, fellow seekers. My name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Damon.
You know, it gives me a sense of comfort that you pass the basket before I speak. That way I don't have to be, like, being blamed if the basket's a little short. I'm real interested to see what I have to say tonight. It kind of gets that way. I want to congratulate all these years of sobriety. I was trying to think about how many bottles of whiskey that is over that many years. Probably put a dent in the profits of a few alcohol producers around the area. I'm very, very amazed. I feel like I'm up here speaking to the choir mostly. A lot of our newcomers. That's cool. 30 days?
2 weeks.
Let me tell you what. The beast is still talking at 2 weeks. I got as much respect for 2 weeks as I do for 50 years. Because that, you know, at, they get a certain point. If I really adopt these as a way of life and this is a design for living. You see this fist? It looks solid, doesn't it? Where did it go? You know, that's like that obsession to drink. See, because it's a verb, it's not a noun. You know, it's the same way with fear. I think that fear is something solid that I'm going to have to carry around with me. I think a resentment is something like the fist, something I'm going to have to carry around with me. I've got this burden to carry around with me. Where did it go? I change and I start taking new actions. And it's as if the thing didn't exist at all. I mean, it's the idea of, like, where does run go when you stop running? It's a nonsensical question. It's an amazing thing about this program is how it can make stuff that seems so real all of a sudden just disappear into thin air. And that's the miracle of it. I remember this guy over here, Wilson M. from Mesquite, Texas. Got a great sense of humor. He said that this program's a real mystery. It's sort of like the old maid who was getting made love to by the invisible man. She felt really good, but she didn't know why. You know, and in a lot of ways, you know, there's programs like that. You know, I just love that guy. But in a lot of ways, how do I explain it? You know, explaining the unexplainable. And until somebody's gone through it, I've just been with my buddy Ernie here, and we thought it was a 6 o'clock meeting, and it's, you know, as an 8, and we took advantage of it and did some step work today. And I watched some real changes. There's a book called As Bill Sees It over here. And in that book, Bill wanted to make some changes to the first 164 pages. And one of the changes that he wanted to make, I'm actually going to get it and bring it over here, is he wanted to change the third step prayer. And in As Bill Sees It on page 210, he's even got the page number for page 63 written on there, but he's changed a word. And I say this prayer whenever I wake up in the morning. In fact, when I first heard the original version of the prayer and I heard the word victory, I said, that seems out of place. I'm a concept guy. You know, I've just done that all my life. I see concepts, and I see this one was out of place. Because in another place in the book, he says, we cease fighting everything and everyone, including alcohol. For by now, sanity will have returned. Well, victory means I'm trying to win a fight or something. That didn't make any sense. Well, here's how Bill changed it. Now, this book, in 1967, when it was published, it was called The AA Way of Life, As Bill Sees It. And then people saw that Bill wanted to make a few changes, and not major, but a few changes to the first 164 pages. So they made him change the title of the book to as Bill sees it, the AA way of life. What's neat about this, by the way, is I was in Vienna, Austria. It's the first time the trip was set up by a guy I met at the International. He was the flag bearer for Hungary at the International. He set up a trip for my wife and I. We went through Austria, and then we went with an AA and an Al-Anon through Hungary. I went to a meeting in Vienna that was as Bill sees it, and it was an English-speaking meeting. Then I went in Sopron, Hungary, which is the place where the Iron Curtain fell. It's a neat place to see. But I went to a meeting in Hungarian. And he had, the guy who spoke really good English said, "Do you need me to translate?" And I said, "No, you don't." And I really didn't, you know, because I could feel what these people were talking about. But here's Bill's version of it. And I use this every morning. It's the first thing I say to myself when I get up. It says, "God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that my transcendence over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life." Now you'd think that transcendence is a big word, right? Well, I figured out it's got the same number of syllables as alcohol, so it can't be all that big. And when I look at it, when you look at the pages 60 to 63, what we have is we have the actor who wants to run the whole show. And he transcends into becoming the agent. And what is an agent? An agent's the guy who's in the background. He's not on the marquee. He's not on the stage. You know, he's transformed into being what I think is the highest rank that I can reach as a human being, which is servant. He's the guy that makes sure the bathrooms are cleaned, you know, the water bill's paid, whatever, that the people there are going to have a good time. And he's not trying to be somebody he's not. He gets to take his own God-given talents and become an agent. I think that's part of this magic that happens, the thing that's unexplainable, this transcendence. I think the other thing that happens there is he's the guy who wants to try and arrange life to suit himself, you know, so then he'll be happy. And at the end, I have a new employer being all-powerful, provides what I need if I stay close to him and perform his work well. That's transcendence. I think it's an excellent word, and I think it really fits in 60 and 63 and probably describes a lot about what happened to me. I was born here in Atlanta in 1955. Well, born in Atlanta in Georgia Baptist Hospital. It's not even there. It's Atlanta Regional now. But I sponsored a guy who lived and grew up in Atlanta, and he found out I was in East Point, three houses down from the Atlanta-East Point border, and said, "No, you're not an Atlanta native." I said, "Okay, fine, whatever." But I grew up, I'm the youngest. I got two older sisters. And, I got no bloody reason to have drank the way I did except that I'm alcoholic. You know? My mom is a registered nurse. She worked at Grady Hospital down there. And when my dad got a job that could allow her to stay at home and keep us, but he first, I remember at 6 years old, my dad asked me if it was okay if he took that traveling job. I think that's pretty cool, you know. He's quite a character. He got slowed down. He was 9 years old. He got run over by a train in Huntington, West Virginia, and lost his leg. His first cousin said that was probably saved his life because he was always into things. But I never considered him handicapped in any way. He water skied. I remember seeing him holding on to the water ski rope with his stump. He had a real short stump, smoking a cigar with his glasses with these orange and yellow bobbers to hang onto the glasses. Had his captain's hat, and he was drinking a beer. And just having a grand old time. He was drinking, that first beer I had and he tasted of was Black Label. And I didn't drink any more beer for a while after that. I see some other people have had Black Label before. But I was also a guy who had, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street at 6 years old, and we were the only two members. I wound up playing a large part in my life for a while. Did anybody else here try and get pleasure by sneaking around? Anybody, do I see a show of hands at all? No, you didn't? Oh, I look at that. Never tried that. But, I smoked cigarettes at 6 years old, and I used to get a whooping for it, and I just go, Earl Mill Iron, right over the top in the back of our hill. We're in a nice neighborhood, but you go right in this little gravel road, and it was the backside of a auto dump yard, and they had a cigarette machine. You'd get them for 35 cents a pack. I remember that. And so I was always kind of experimenting around, you know. And after my dad got that job, we moved up to Marietta. And I had a little trouble in the elementary school there, and I kept, you know, they have kids on Ritalin now. They had me on paddling. I don't know if anybody else, have me on that. And my mom took me to a child psychologist, and they just said, well, he's bored. So my parents sacrificed a lot. They didn't have a ton of money, but they sacrificed to send me to a private school. Which, by the way, that's where I met Robert B., who's the chairman of the Atlanta Roundup Committee now. I was telling people earlier, yeah, Robert had straight A's while he was there at the school. And then I found out later on when he came into AA, he had gone to jail more times than I had. And I called him an overachiever, you know. But you know, it was a place where I had a great, you know, but I was a C student. You know, anybody else here been told you had a lot of potential if you only applied yourself? Do I see any others? You're not shaking your head this time. But, yeah, I was one of those, you know. And but also I was sort of I got bullied when I was, you know, at that school. And but it was fun. It's strange about that because I was one of the first kids in the neighborhood up in Marietta. And we had a three-story tree hut. We had three, you know, levels to, you know, three sides on it, sections. We had a parking deck for bicycles. In fact, Russell Bryson down the street tested it for us. And he rode up and went right off the back side of it. And he's a crumpled mass. And we look over the rail and say, Russell, you okay? And he says, we need rails. Good. That's great. That's it. That was our engineering design process. So we had a good time, you know. And by the way, my parents asked me where we got the wood and said, oh, the builder donated it. And the builder came by and said, where'd you get the wood? Oh, our parents supplied it. So I, at an early age, you know, what can I say? But I was also a child of the 60s, and they say if you remember it, you weren't there. But the first thing I did, I was 8 years old, I sniffed glue. My sister turned me on to marijuana at 10 as a step up. And I drank alcoholic just to get drunk at age 12. We put the clear stuff in the Sprite bottle from each of the liquor cabinets from the parent. And the color stuff we put in a Coke bottle. And we made sure we drank it all so we wouldn't get in trouble. What we did is they all came over to my house, got sick. And my mom was away this one day. She wasn't away from the house very often. My sister came home, cleaned us up, you know, did all that, made the alibis for us. I didn't have to go to school the next day. So I got drunk, had a good time, no consequences. You know, and they say this is a progressive disease, and it goes from, you know, fun and then fun with consequences and then nothing but consequences towards the end. And I think that's, but you know, for me, I was asked at age 15 by one of the hippies that I would help him make candles down at the park, down in Piedmont Park, and sell joints, you know, out of my guitar case, you know, around Piedmont Park. But David Perkins, and he said, he asked me a question at 15, and I was in this Lutheran church there, kind of. I wasn't so much, I was a youth leader, but mostly what I was doing there was some women there, you know, and the girls and all that stuff, so that kind of lured me in. But he said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? And I thought that's a pretty heavy question for a 15, but it's an interesting question. You know, if I'd have been born in Saudi Arabia, I'd be Islam. If I was born in, you know, India, I could be Sikh or Muslim or Buddhist or any number of religions. So I started looking at the other side of the world. In fact, I got my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. They had a house there on the lake. I always wanted to live there. And I'm like, it's a town of 2,000. I mean, and I stayed in Atlanta on 12th Street between Peachtree and West Peachtree. Some of the neighbors got robbed and all this other stuff, and I had my battery stolen a couple of times and got my edumacation in the inner city when I was there. And I worked at Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I had I was always a kind of a hard worker, though. I mean, I was given a lot of those qualities. They gave me the original job as a temporary job shredding insurance documents in an air conditioning room. And I just blew them away by just shredding and shredding, seeing how fast I could do them. And they gave me a full-time job. And the first thing to do was to put together a Phillipsburg six-station inserting machine that inserted mail into envelopes. And I had the best title I've ever had in any job. I was chief inserter at an insurance company with a lot of women there, and but I was always a bit shy and everything. I didn't really take much advantage of all of my title, but I did learn one thing is as I was sitting there working, and I saw these guys in the suits and ties, and some of them, you know, around the big the computers at the time, they had the cards and the card readers and the whole deal. But I just said, you know, it might not be a bad idea to get a college education. And so I finally decided to apply myself, and I wound up going to a junior college in Alabama. Auburn wouldn't have me because of my grades. And that was sort of like an extension to Alabama high school. So it really, with me coming in with a college prep, you know, education, even when I didn't apply myself, it was pretty easy to pull a 4.0 at this little place. And I decided I wanted to go for higher education, so after my, because it's just an associate degree, and I called my parents, who said I could go just about anywhere. You know, that, and within reason. And so I called up Colorado at the, when you could call the old long distance information. You guys remember that? You know, 555-1212 with your, and I said, what colleges do you have in Colorado? And they said, Colorado and Colorado State. And I said, hold on. And I pulled a penny out of my pocket and flipped it, and it was tails. So I said, Colorado State. And that was my planning for higher education. And, I wound up going there, and they actually had a good program in Eastern Studies. And on the first weekend I was there, they were handing out refrigerators. And there was only so many they could have, and I got down there, and there was two gals sitting on a couch. And I sat down, and I butted in the conversation. Now, I know some of you will find that hard to believe that I would do that. But I wound up introducing the one girl to my roommate, and they got married 6 months before my wife and I got married, and we're now married 38 years. And we met, that was it'll be 42 years ago in June. And I like the guy who said, we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. The other thing is we decided right before we got married that divorce wasn't an option, and I've really greatly benefited from that. And you know, I had wanted to go to China, and she did not want to go. I wanted to go there and teach English. It was kind of my goal. And I actually broke up with her and went around Colorado with my parents. And I realized on that trip that I wanted this woman to be the mother of my children. And for that, she's just done a fantastic job. And now we've got a grandchild, and I'll see her sitting in there with him, and they'll have 10 books as they go to bed at night, just reading and laughing and cutting up and cackling. And, you know, like that guy Norm Alpe said, sometimes it's just seconds and inches, you know, seconds and inches. So, but I tell you what, in the late 70s, I quit smoking weed, and the circle kind of disappeared. And I was also kind of a seeker. You know, God could and would if he were sought. And during the 70s, and I when I went to school up in Colorado, I took a hiatus for a little bit, and I worked in a nursing home for about a year and a half. I was an orderly there, and I got to see people with 75 years of marriage, 105 years old, 90 years, you know. Since I've been in sobriety, when I first got sober, I started doing a job where I do non-medical home health care one day a week, and I've taken care of some amazing people. I've had the last lucid conversation on earth with a guy 94 years old, Old Bailey, and what had happened is I got sober in August of 2004, and this was November of 2004 when I first started taking care of them. And July of 2005, they both got the flu, and she recovered, but he never really recovered. And so we started doing more days worth of coverage, and I couldn't do that many because I started rebuilding my own business. But I was able to do a couple of days. And this Thursday, I came in, and boy, the daughter was just beside herself because Bailey had been up and down all night long. And she just, I said, well, I could just sit and have him talk. And the wife is sitting in the bed next to him, and he just starts talking for an hour and a half. in the morning, and I do all the chores that I'm supposed to do and everything, and then I talk with him for another half an hour in the afternoon. He said he grew up in North Forsyth County, and they used to have to take the crop. He quit school at 8 years old to go back and work in the cotton fields. And they used to have to carry the crops in and go pick up supplies in Gainesville, which was 20 miles away. And I can still hear him say, "And a mule goes 4 miles an hour." So it'd take him 5 hours to get there and back, you know. He talked about getting robbed working at a convenience store by somebody, you know, it looked like, you know, one of the Dillinger or whatever, you know, it was during that time. And he eloped with his wife, his girlfriend of 8 years, and they were in their 20s. And finally, they moved down to Marietta, and he worked for a guy named Ernest Barrett. Anybody heard of Barrett Parkway and Ernest Barrett? He drove a truck for Red Rock that later got purchased by PepsiCo, and he had stock. And he was just always a very careful and frugal man. And when his daughter's husband refinanced the house and took all the money and left him, Bailey went down to the bank and just straightened it all out. Well, Bailey looked up at me, and he said, "Well, you know, I got the nurses coming to take care of me in the evening. I got you coming to take care of me in the morning." I said, "Not bad for an old plow boy." You know, a lot of what this program is exactly that, isn't it? Tonight, when you lay your head down on your pillow, are you able to look back and go, "Not a bad job for an old alcoholic"? You know? And his whole success in his life, and he was an alcoholic, he didn't know I was in the program, it was unnecessary. But I'll tell you something, and I don't know if you'll pick up on this, it took me a bit to pick up on it. But it took him as much time to remember 94 years of life as it took for me to remember lunch with my daughter the week before. I don't know if you get that or not. Maybe I'll let it sink in. But this is, you know, about right here, right now. And at 94 years old, looks a whole lot like 62. You know? But I'll tell you what, that idea, he lived his life based on principles. And he raised those grandkids while his daughter went and got a master's degree. So I was working at that nursing home, and so I learned some of these lessons while I was there in college. And I went ahead and we got married, and I came back here, and had to get residency again in Georgia. So I worked selling luggage at Rich's for a while and doing some other things. And we had a great marriage. My wife and I was not drinking alcoholically because I had learned a number of lessons at that nursing home, these principles of life. And also what my mom had taught me how to do, you know. And I was going to go into international business, and I was on the same floor as the marketing department, and they had American Marketing Association chapter, and I knew to get connected up with the professional world, and I did that, and all of a sudden I was president, and then all of a sudden I was writing a database in Fortran in a UNIVAC computer. And what happened was I took this history degree, and it turns out it fit very well into programming, because programming is the history of data as it moves through a system. It's people interacting with systems. And it took those same, what I didn't know, in fact, my father-in-law is a retired cancer surgeon. He just passed away this last summer. And I came down, I was taking Chinese history and philosophy, hair down to here, riding this Honda 125 motorcycle, first time I meet him, you know. My wife said, "He's a little on the rough side, you know." And he said, about that degree, he said, "What you going to do with that degree?" I said, "Well, I've always considered myself to be a Renaissance man." He said, "What the hell is that?" And I said, "You know, back in the Renaissance, you studied ants for a couple of months, write a book on it, world's expert on ants, and cannibals, wine, or music, or something like that." And it's kind of what I wound up doing. I really specialize in being a generalist. you know, and a broad range of different things. And it turns out I was successful going through Equifax for a while and then in HP. I could communicate between the different silos, from the marketing department to the technicians to the, you know. I had my master's degree turned out to be in marketing and marketing research, because that's what the division of Equifax that I got a job with. And they wound up paying for my master's degree. And I became a data center manager there, and I was climbing up and everything. Now, there's a book Bill Wilson was reading at the time, and he had his hot flash in, what was it, around December 12th of 1934 in Towns Hospital. And it was called The Variety of Religious Experience, and I'm just about through with it. I've read it before, but I've really gone through it this time. But I tell you what, a little warning, it starts like a cold car in winter. He spends a lot of time telling you what he is not going to talk about. But there are some jewels in that little thing. But one of the things he talks about is the difference between, you know, what is the common things that somebody who's had a spiritual experience have. And that's kind of, it's a neat kind of topic. And one of the things he said was there's a shift from pessimism to optimism. And to me, it has a lot to do with our 10th tradition. You know, the fewer negative opinions I have on outside issues, the less I get drawn into public controversy. I'll tell you what, that tradition, and the whole thing about the traditions and living them in my life has been a major deal. And my wife doesn't need to know a thing about them. But that was one right there. So what happened, though, for me is as my son was born in 84, my daughter in 89, and, you know, I started shifting towards pessimism. What was wrong with my wife? What was wrong with my life? What was wrong with my job? What's wrong with the world? And I had a guy work for me in the data center, and he had a bachelor party. He went to a belly dancing thing, and then we went to they were going to a strip joint. And I said, okay, camaraderie, I'll go along. Well, this was a pull-your-pants-down club with style, you know, and I went, I'm not getting this at home, you know. And then I thought, was working late at night programming, I'll go get myself a massage. You know, I had never had a massage. Go down and the gal offers me the full treatment. And I took her up on it. But, you know, Mama raised me better than that. And I had guilt about it. I had to rationalize and justify. I said, you know, in China and Japan, they have concubines. Only problem is I'm not in China or Japan. My wife's neither Chinese or Japanese. And I ain't telling her about it. But, you know, I started to drink after that. I didn't stop my behavior. I started acting out, but then I started to drink to cover up the guilt. Because Mama did raise me better than that. You know, Clancy, one time on a talk, said, the mind, when faced with sufficient conflict, will alter its view of reality in order to resolve the conflict. I see some nodding out there. And I'll rationalize and justify in order to reduce the conflict. Well, wound up getting a job with a Hewlett Packard doing data center building. I was 24/7, so nobody knew where I was or when I was or what I was doing. And when I was there, I could put on the afterburners and get stuff done and get enough done. But one of the times, one of those companies smelled my breath around their several million dollars worth of equipment, and they noted it. I told them that, you know, I think it was medication they were probably smelling. It was a medication. I finally went to a doctor and told him what I was doing. He said, oh, you're self-medicating. Boy, that is so true, isn't it? Dr. Damon, self-medicator. I diagnosed the problem. I wrote the prescription, I filled the prescription, and I took the prescription. And I cut out all the middlemen. And I started this process of drinking and quitting. When I first came into the program, there was a guy, Mr. Ed. I don't know if anybody remembers Mr. Ed, one of the characters in AA, which is saying something. But I see a nod over there. Mr. Ed was a character. But he introduced me to the jail meetings in Cobb County. And where was I going with that? Anyway, I'll come back. I began when I first came in to look for ways of being of service when I first came in it. But I'm going to roll back and see if I can get me sober here. So I started, I started doing the jail meetings then. Recently, I've been over at the Cobb County work release. And when I was in there, I'm back on track. There was a guy there, and he said, you know, you've convinced me when I get out, I'm going to quit drinking and using. And I said, for God's sake, don't quit. And he said, what do you mean? I said, quitting doesn't work. In fact, you know, if I was going to write a book on not drinking, my first step would be quit drinking. And I got, you know, when I first saw the first step, I said, why wouldn't that be quit drinking? And isn't that the first thing? Don't drink, go to meetings? It doesn't say that. In fact, the first part of the first step says quitting doesn't work. I'm powerless to quit. I will not be able to quit and keep quitting. I tried it many times. See, what happened is I quit. I'd feel pretty good about myself, kind of brush myself off, go cruising along, all of a sudden get a little bit restless, a little bit irritable, a little and you know where that's coming from? Those negative opinions. That pessimism again. The negative opinions. And that's where the source of all that restless, irritable, and discontent. Today I have one negative opinion, and that's about negative opinions. You know, well, for instance, one of the traditions is, what if I don't have any rules for friendship? What if I have no rules for friendship? There's no, if you do this and I'll be your friend. No. And I tell you what, that's an amazing rule right there. So, the other part, in the second part of the first step, I got plan B. Ready? Plan B. I'm going to manage my life in such a way that I won't have to drink. How's that sound? Second part, first step. That don't work either. Now what am I supposed to do? Step two. I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Which, by the way, I heard it mentioned, that's not insanity, is not the opposite of sanity. Unsanity. There may be a thing called unsanity, meaning I'm capable of sanity. I just ain't doing it right now. Insane people, they just put them away and throw away the key. But I think I was more unsane than I was insane. So I started this thing back and forth. You know, by the way, they put me on probation in April of 2001. I quit. I put on the afterburners. I was getting accolades. Boss was saying, manager across the country. I didn't have one right there with me. He said, yeah, I'll put your name in to get you off probation. And then an ex-presidential candidate, Carly, laid off everybody who was on probation. And this is in August of 2001. And so I said, when I come back here, in a year from now, I'm going to be a millionaire. And today I'm a millionaire many times over in a completely different currency. See, because I didn't want the car. I wanted the way I thought I was going to feel when I got the car. I didn't want to have a job or a certain position. I wanted the quality of life I thought I was going to have when I got it. And today I can have that whether I have the circumstances or not. That is a new employer being all-powerful. He provides what I need as long as I stay close to him and performance work well. So I started this role. I'm still not drinking. 9/11 comes. I'm over in Birmingham working on this computer program for this sports deal that I'm trying to work up. And I watch, my sister says, come look at this, and the towers are burning. And I know that my industry is going to change drastically, and it did. And I held off for another 2 days of quitting. And then they went to a German club, and I said, no, I'm not going, I'm not drinking. But I knew where their blackjack was. Anybody else know where the blackjack is? And that, you know. And so I was going to have one drink. Well, I had three. Now, I didn't drink the whole bottle because I like pleasure by sneaking around. But the next morning at 9 o'clock, I was sitting at the liquor store waiting for it to open. It opened at 9:30. And you know what I did, because I'm now an alcoholic. I've crossed the line, and I waited. God willing, I will never have to sit in the parking lot and wait for a liquor store to open ever again. King Alcohol had me at that point. And it was a roller coaster for several years. And I quit in September of 2003, and in Thanksgiving of 2003, I made an excuse. We're over in Birmingham. Made an excuse, go get $300 out of the ATM, drive all the way back to Atlanta saying I got to go see a client. I didn't have a client to go see. Went over to Mardi Gras, went over to Cheshire Bridge Road to a massage parlor there. 3 or 4 days later, I had a 105-degree temperature. And when the temperature broke, some very strange things started happening with my body. And I waited until February before going to the doctor, just wishing it would go away. And I thought I might have gotten some sexually transmitted disease. But I couldn't drive now to the doctors. I wasn't not drinking anymore. I had to drink to drive to get over there. And I wouldn't pee in the cup because then they'd find out and maybe take away my solution. See, if I'm an alcoholic, alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol relieves the symptoms of alcoholism. Alcohol relieves the symptoms of alcoholism. It's a very poor choice, but it does relieve the symptoms. Well, finally, that's when in May, I finally went to that doctor and told him, and that's when he said I was self-medicating. Well, in July 2004, my wife gave me the ultimatum letter, because, see, I'd been drinking all this time. She didn't know it. I smoked cigarettes for 8 to 10 years. She didn't know it. I was smoking, hanging out my head out the bathroom window. She's sleeping on the couch. You know, they have a great question for an alcoholic. What would a grown-up do? You know, I'm doing what I did at 12 years old. So, finally, I told her I was going to go see Kaiser Behavioral Services, and I lied about it. I didn't make the appointment. But I quit on Monday, August the 9th, I quit. My sobriety date I used is August the 10th of 2004, because that's the first day without a drink that I did not have one. But I was still quitting. And on Thursday night, I got my 1 hour of sleep, 3 o'clock in the morning. By this time, I'm a confirmed atheist. Not only do I know there is no God, but I'm pretty damn sure I can convince you there is no God. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said the three-word prayer of an atheist. And I said, I need help. And I didn't know about the line, fully concede to your innermost self, but that's exactly what happened. And I remember standing there and walking around the bedroom with a strange feeling going, this is like something out of a TV show. I didn't say movie, I don't know why, but it's just a TV show. It just felt so different. And I went, because I'm thinking about lying to my wife again, how am I going to lie to her again? And I was tired of lying. Has anybody been there before? Keeping those damn plates spinning. And finally, I just said, well, what am I going to not lie about? And I said, what am I going to tell her the truth about? Everything. And I got my daughter off to school, because my wife's drinking to go to sleep now, you know. And I get my daughter off to school, and I wake my wife up, and I said, I've been an SOB, you know, and basically outlined everything I did, except the cigarettes. I still had 2 cigarettes left. But also, her dad's a cancer surgeon, and she hated smoking. It's almost the worst thing I could have done was smoke. I waited till Tuesday, but I told her about it. But that day I quit, and I've not had a smoke since. Because, you see, it wasn't about quitting the smoking. It was beginning to tell the truth. You see, this is not a program about quitting. This is a program about starting. When I started to want to be a good father. And when I look on the list of what good fathers do, drinking is not on the list. When I want to be a good husband, you just heard my story. Drinking is definitely not on the list. And there's a huge difference between not on the list and quitting. Because if I'm quitting, it's still on the list. I had to seek. That's why I like fellow seekers. So from there, it's been a series of a lot of journeys with the service. I want to tell you one story in the service. There's so many of them. I got involved in the jails early on. The CDs started with a resentment. I was doing computer work for a lawyer in the program. And he had gone to Dallas, Texas, came back with one CD. He flew down there, rented a hotel, came back with one CD. And it looked commercial. Now, I took copyright infringement law in my business master's, you know, business law degree class. because I wanted to know how to copy stuff and get away with it, because I was copying software and, you know, anything I could. And so I'm figuring this is illegal, you know, to copy this. So what, this guy's a hypocrite. And not only that, he's cheap. He could have bought a whole case of CDs. He's got this big house, buy the fancy car. Another thing, lazy. He didn't want me to show him how to burn the CDs. He wanted me to. I say, fine. Well, it turned out to be Ed Mutum. Has anybody ever heard of Ed Mutum? Ed Mutum's story of forgiveness made the national news. And I wondered, well, is there anything like this? And Santa Claus gave me a tape. John Cornelius. And he had made a tape of himself in Resaca. And he said, can you convert this to CD for me? I wanted to hand it out to some people. I said, I think I can. I've got it on my resume. I'm capable of conversing with inanimate objects. So I made a copy of it. It's a great story. And I handed it out to some people. Where'd you get this? I converted it from cassette tape. People said, you can do that? I got a whole closet full of these cassette tapes. All of a sudden, Joe and Charlie, you know, the series, you know, Sandy coming out. Loved Finding Sandy. And all of these people coming out. And then I thought, well, do I charge for these? I said, I don't want to sit there and have to do a balance sheet to show whether I'm making money off of this or not. So I just told them, no, but I accept blank CDs. So people will bring me at a time. Somebody will bring me 12 CDs, you know, that they found in the house. And another guy brought me 900. Nice. You know, and so it's just this thing that's sort of kind of gone along. And now it's got a website. I got 2,100 on there. And it's a website the way I wanted it done. I wanted to be able to read a synopsis of it. I wanted to, you know, I got to be able to design it, and I was looking at it, it's like 500 unique IP addresses each week that are hitting the site. Now, let me tell you what's amazing about this. You know, one of the things I found out that was the nature of my wrong was that I was treating women as objects. I was treating women as objects. And that was at the core of so much with my wife, all of it. Well, it turns out that 2/3 of the talks on WeJoy are male. There's only been 1 week in the last year when there's been more males downloaded than females. See, I didn't know how I was going to make amends to women, you know. And God finds a way, doesn't he? There's an excellent pamphlet. I'm going to finish up because we're wrapping it up. But has anybody ever seen a member's eye view of Alcoholics Anonymous? This is one of the best pamphlets that we put out there. And at the very end of it, page 27, he says, more than 16 years ago, 4 men, my boss, my physician, my pastor, and the one friend I had left, working singly and together, maneuvered me into AA. Tonight, if they were to ask me, tell us, what did you find? I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. Isn't that so much about what we do? We share our experience, not our theories, you know. It seems the blind do see. The lame do walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. Thank you for letting me share. Amen.